Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Edward Elgar, brilliant composer or imperialist relic? I'm John Schaefer, and today on Soundcheck, this year marks the 150th anniversary of the British composer, Sir Edward Elgar. But critics can't agree on whether to celebrate or not. Some say he embodies the worst of England's imperial past. Others point out that his remarkable life and music was a triumph of talent over prejudice. We'll have a debate. I'm the grand man. Later in the show, nearly 30 years into his songwriting career, Nick Cave is not going gracefully into musical maturity. He joins us to talk about a side project called Grinderman that explores an even darker side of his music, with songs about sex and the middle-aged man, and Filipino hip-hop made in Queens. All of that on Soundcheck. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The U.S. economy grew at a 3.4% pace in the second quarter, the gross domestic product's strongest showing in more than a year. But analysts are keeping a close eye on Wall Street today, where the stock continues to show declines a day after suffering its second worst day of the year. Art Hogan, chief market analyst with Jefferies & Company, says the market was due for a pullback.
You know, if you look back over the last 12 months, the Dow coming into yesterday had been up about 25%. Coming into today, it was up about 10% on a year-to-date basis. So you have to rationalize the kind of gains you've had with the fundamental backdrop. And I think that, you know, you make new highs, you're bound to get volatility.
The Dow is now down about 79 points at 13,394, with the Nasdaq down nearly 14 at 2585. The White House is publicly standing by Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, who's under fire by lawmakers. Several Democrats want a special prosecutor to investigate whether Gonzalez perjured himself. When asked this week about the administration's warrantless wiretapping program and his role in the dismissals of U.S. attorneys, NPR's David Green has this from the White House.
At issue is a debate back in 2004 over the government's wiretapping program. On Capitol Hill this week, Attorney General Gonzalez insisted that top officials in the Bush administration were all in agreement that the program was legal. But 2 days later, FBI Director Robert Mueller suggested the program was exactly what officials were fighting over in 2004, when there were threats of resignation and even a bedside hospital visit to then-Attorney General John Ashcroft to get his sign-off for the program. White House spokeswoman Dana Perino was asked about the apparent discrepancy between Gonzalez and Mueller. She said Gonzalez was in a tough spot when he testified because the program is classified, and as she put it, the attorney general was testifying with one hand tied behind his back. She said the president supports Gonzalez, and she accused Democrats of being on a crusade to destroy the attorney general. David Green, NPR News, The White House.
U.S. troops clash with militiamen loyal to the anti-American cleric Muqtada al-Sadr in Iraq's holy city of Karbala. Four gunmen along with five civilians were killed. More than 20 were wounded. From Baghdad, NPR's Joel Riddle has details.
The firefight started when the American military, in tandem with the Iraqi army, conducted an early morning raid on a house occupied by a Mehdi army leader. After a two-hour battle, U.S. soldiers surrounded a local hospital where it was thought the gunmen were seeking treatment. Karbala's governor denounced the raid, claiming the U.S. failed to get local Iraqi approval, and all roads coming and going from the city have been shut down. Baghdad was mostly quiet. The city is under mid-afternoon curfew every Friday. The calm was in stark contrast to the day before, when a truck bomb exploded in a mixed neighborhood, killing at least 30 and wounding more than 100. Joel Riddle, NPR News, Baghdad.
From Washington, this is NPR News.
WNYC New York, 79 degrees now, partly sunny skies at 204. A week after his funeral, Officer Russell Timoshenko was promoted to the rank of detective at a special ceremony at One Police Plaza. His family sat in the front row of the auditorium, and Mayor Bloomberg and Police Commissioner Kelly presented his parents with his gold shield. Timoshenko's cousin, Anastasia Apanasik, says it's bittersweet.
Today is a great celebration, but of course, it would have been much more happier if Russell was here with us to share this promotion. We know he worked so hard, and he always wanted to be a police officer.
The 23-year-old was shot this month after he and his partner pulled over a stolen SUV in Brooklyn. Officer Herman Yan was shot and wounded, and he was also promoted to detective today. Three men are being charged in the case. Police investigating a fiery crash that left six people dead have tentatively identified five of the victims as members of a Bronx family originally from Trinidad. The six were killed when their car crossed a median near Suffolk, Virginia, and crashed head-on into a truck. Governor Spitzer has announced a program that will offer homeowners with risky mortgages the opportunity to refinance and avoid possible foreclosure. Under the plan, the state will offer at-risk homeowners the ability to refinance their current mortgages with 30-year or 40-year fixed-rate mortgages at competitive interest rates. The aging United Nations headquarters will undergo a $1 billion makeover. The first-ever overhaul is aimed at bringing the landmarked but leaking glass and steel complex into compliance with safety and fire codes. The 7-year project is due to begin this fall. Partly to mostly cloudy skies tonight with scattered thunderstorms, low near 70. Right now in Central Park, 79 degrees and partly sunny. WNYC New York at 2:06.
Support for NPR comes from Travelocity, with customer support available all trip long, so you'll never roam alone. Travelocity.com or 1-888-TRAVELOCITY.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Later on today's show, singer-songwriter Nick Cave talks about sex and middle age, but we begin with the 150th anniversary this year of Sir Edward Elgar, the composer of this familiar music, Pomp and Circumstance. But it's also the year that the Bank of England has removed Elgar from the £20 note, and a debate has been raging about his true musical talent. Was he a truly original composer, or was he a parochial relic, a symbol of England's imperialist past? Joining us for some perspective on this debate is Leon Botstein, the president of Bard College, conductor, and the man behind next month's Bard Music Festival, which this year is called Elgar and His World. Also joining us is the British cultural critic Norman Lebrecht, whose latest book is The Life and Death of Classical Music. Norman's on the phone with us from London. And Norman, I will start with you. The traditional view of Elgar has been that this guy in the late 19th century almost single-handedly put England on the musical map after the 200 years since Purcell's death, when it seemed like nothing was happening. Isn't that the mark of a really great composer?
No, it's the mark of somebody who breaks a drought. I mean, the English musical drought, the idea of England as a land without music, really extends from the death of Handel in 1759. Handel was such a huge figure that he crushed the life out of English composers, and for the next 150 years, none of them really rose up to any kind of international standard. And then the vast presence of Mendelssohn in the 1830s and 1840s in England further served to depress musical creativity. They simply couldn't match that sort of thing. So Elgar was in the right place at the right time and came up with the right work. And in 1899, with Enigma Variations, he produced a work that instantly appealed to conductors. Its form was familiar, it was easily programmable, and it was taken up all over the world. Hans Richter, the great German conductor, was the first to acclaim it. Richard Strauss took it on, Arthur Nikisch. And so there was this perception of an English musical revival that stemmed from Elgar, and that perception, yes, still prevails unto this day. But it is, for reasons that I'm sure we're going to discuss, not the only side of the story. It is partly false.
Okay. Leon Botstein, I'm going to assume that you disagree with Norman, otherwise you wouldn't be putting together this 3-weekend festival with panels and symposia and concerts dealing with Elgar and his world. What is it about Elgar that attracted you to him for this year's Bard Music Festival?
Well, I don't disagree with Mr. Lebrecht's account of how Elgar came on the scene. I'm not really, in love with the question about evaluating a composer as if he were in a beauty contest. Elgar is undoubtedly an important figure in the sort of history of late 19th century and 20th century English music. So the festival is really opening the very question you started with. You know, what are we to make of this figure of undoubtable importance? And with a tremendous variety of work, some of it, I think, is really quite fantastic, including the Enigma Variations. He's not original in the sense of a path-breaking originality, as we might associate with Schoenberg or Stravinsky. But there's a tremendous amount, I think, of good music that is really first-rate and filled with complex, both compositional and emotional significance. And it's worth taking a look at, and it's worth taking a look at his contemporaries, because this notion of England as having a big drought is certainly right if you take it from a very distant perspective. But there are a lot of good composers, both his contemporaries, immediate successors, and some predecessors.
All right, we're speaking with Leon Botstein, who's running the Bard Music Festival this year, focusing on Sir Edward Elgar, and with Norman Lebrecht, whose latest book is The Life and Death of Classical Music. And we're talking about the significance of Sir Edward Elgar in his sesquicentennial year, his 150th anniversary. Norman, just from reading some of the things that are in the British press these days, it seems like you can't have a conversation about Elgar in England without politics somehow creeping into it. You know, the idea that he is a symbol of imperialism, of the imperial past of Great Britain.
John, that's absolutely right. Standing where I am in the center of London, you cannot have a non-contentious conversation about Elgar. There are those who claim him as the quintessence of Englishness, and others who will claim him as the quintessence of imperialism. The general consensus in England is that he is a great composer, and I'm some way out on a limb in saying, no, he isn't. He's a composer of three important works. He's a composer who made a absolutely vital breakthrough. He is an icebreaker. But aside from those three works, his significance beyond the shores of this island is really quite limited. And if you want proof of that, you will find that apart from Mr. Botstein's festival at Bard, there is very little going on around the world for Elgar's sesquicentennial. Not just around the world, there's nothing going on in Scotland.
But the Scots
have taken a very, very clear view that Elgar is a composer of limited interest, and more than that, one who is identified entirely in their minds with English imperialism. And he was a creature of that period. You cannot escape that with Pomp and Circumstance, which you played at the beginning of the show. Arouses instantly those evocation of the great red line that England spread around the world between the middle of the 18th century and the middle of the 20th.
All right, Norman, let me give Leon a chance to respond.
First of all, there's no doubt there's a side of Elgar which is a kind of pompous, imperial, somewhat embarrassing grandiosity. There's also an intimate Elgar which invented a kind of nostalgia for an English countryside, a pre-modern England, and there's also the Elgar that is engaged with things like the pre-Raphaelite aesthetics, with the religious questions having to do with the Oxford movement and Newman. It's a very complex question, but where I disagree with Norman Lebrecht is that there are not only three works that are worth hearing. And the fact that it's not known around the rest of the world is precisely why we're doing a festival. Because I think that Elgar has suffered in a way that some other composers have suffered, whether you think of Defaya or Szymanowski, or the best case of breaking out of this mold is Janáček, who was once a regional figure and became an international figure. The question is, can this be done with Elgar? Norman Lebrecht is correct that up to now, the interest in Elgar is very limited. Even a great work like The Dream of Drama has little traction outside of England. The question is that really right? I mean, there are some of these works, I think there are more than three, that merit close scrutiny. The other thing, of course, is you do a festival to cut against the grain. You know, all the cliches of music history, some of them are right, some of them are not right.
All right, well, you've both mentioned the Enigma variations. That certainly has to be one of three or more great works that Elgar composed. Let's hear a little bit of Sir Adrian Bolt leading the London Symphony Orchestra. This actually is ranked among Norman Lebrecht's top 100 recorded milestones of the 20th century. Here's music by Sir Edward Elgar. just a little bit of the Enigma Variations, an early success story for Sir Edward Elgar, whose sesquicentennial we are celebrating, or at least we're marking it this year. Some people are celebrating. Leon Botstein, for example, who will be leading the Bard College annual Bard Music Festival on two more weekends in August and then bringing it here to New York in October. The festival this year called Elgar and His World. But we're also speaking with Norman Lebrecht, the London-based cultural critic. His latest book is The Life and Death of Classical Music, and Norman's not so sure how much celebrating there is to be
done. If I may, I mean, I think, you know, Norman said there were three works. You know, I think the two symphonies, I think of Falstaff in the South. You know, I think of not only Gerontius, but I think, you know, The Kingdom is worth a close look. These oratorios, which are a little bit strange as a genre for us. You know, the same, you know, take Mendelssohn, which Norman Lebrecht correctly says dominated English taste in the mid-19th century. The reality is that, you know, as we enter the 20th century, there are only a few Mendelssohn works which really had any traction. And I think it pays to take a second look, because maybe the cliché about what is really great in Mendelssohn is limited. And the case may be the same with Elgar, and that the eloquence you hear in this Nimrod variation, which, you know, has become very nationalized, there's a kind of restrained intimacy, a kind of eloquence, a kind of struggle. There's a lot of ambivalence. It's not so simple. And I think there's something to be said for this music.
Leon, do we as Americans approach Elgar with fresher ears than people in England, for whom the political, the idea of music somehow having imperialist baggage associated with it?
I think the Americans have very little acquaintance with Elgar, and to some extent there is always a small veneer of Americans who always like anything English. I don't happen, I'm not particularly an Anglophile or Anglophobic, but I do think that not a lot of the music is actually in the repertory.
Mm-hmm.
The two symphonies have entered a little bit, but it is certainly the choral music is practically unknown.
Right. Norman, you did say there were three great works, Enigma Variations. I'm going to assume the Cello Concerto is one of them.
That's right.
And then what's the third?
I agree entirely with Leon Botstein that it does pay to explore the unfamiliar. It also pays occasionally to put a bet on a long shot at 100-1. For those of us to whom Elgar is familiar, I would say, you know, perhaps it doesn't pay that much. Yes, in my view, there are three works of great concentration, great intensity, where every note on the page and every note in the air is worth its weight in gold. The Enigma Variations, where we heard the passage that we heard, Elgar wrote above that passage "nobil mente." He coined a term for its actual nobility, and the nobility was not that of aristocracy, but of the human spirit. And you feel that right the way through this tribute to friendship, or to the possibility of friendship, the possibility of connection between human souls. That's undeniably a great work. The Cello Concerto, which is a valediction, written at the end of the Second World War, as Elgar's wife is dying, is a work of the most irresistible poignancy and intensity. It's also one of the most difficult works to play for a cellist, because there are no rests at all for the soloists in the whole thing. The solo is at its start to the cello is at its start to finish, and that grips the attention like nothing else. I would say the Violin Concerto is a great work. There is also the Violin Sonata, another late work that is a fine piece. The problem with Elgar, the problem that I find with Elgar, is that in almost everything else, there are stretches of ennui. He writes great, long works. He writes The Dream of Gerontius, but there are passages in The Dream of Gerontius where if you went out and you had a drink, and you maybe put a flutter on a horse, and you came back, you would feel you hadn't missed anything.
Okay,
there are patches of the same in the two symphonies. This is a man of humble origins, of Catholic origins.
Right, and I wanted to ask you about that in a moment, but let's hear a little bit of the Elgar Cello Concerto in the great recording by Jacqueline Dupré. Just a little bit of Elgar's cello concerto, Jacqueline Dupre's recording is the 12th biggest selling classical album of all time. That also coming from Norman LeBrecht's latest book, The Life and Death of Classical Music.
May I interject here for a moment?
Leon Botstein, yes, by all means.
First of all, I don't agree with this boredom argument. I mean, everybody's boredom is a subjective matter. One could say this about Parsifal, it's what Stravinsky said about Parsifal. These are matters of taste. I don't think they're long stretches of unreal.
Oh, they're not matters of taste.
And
They're actually matters of the intensity and the originality of the writing of the piece. There are novels in which there are very long passages in which the writer shows no originality and is just using them as a span towards his next great idea.
I don't think it's a matter of taste.
The idiom of Elgar and the language of Elgar appeals more than others.
Hold on, they don't find these dull. Norman, hold on just a second. Let Leon finish his thought, and then I want to come back to you.
So I don't think they're large stretches of boredom. I also think that the writing that Elgar, I don't think, is that much of an outsider. I mean, he was immensely successful despite being a Catholic, and he became, master of the king's music. He was an obnoxious man, unfortunately. He sold his Galliano violin to buy a billiard table. He was a kind of more Catholic than the Pope himself in wanting to be the sort of symbol of a country gentleman. Now, you have to put all that aside and say whether there is, there's a lot of intimacy written into this music. A lot of it, I think Falstaff is a terrific tone poem. In the South is a terrific one. Strauss admired him, and he was no fool. And George Bernard Shaw was maybe not the most discerning critic from my point of view, but also thought well of him. This is an open question whether it's only three works.
Well, it is an open question, and this is a good time to be asking it. Elgar's Sesquicentennial. Leon Botstein is producing the Bard Music Festival, Elgar and His World, on consecutive weekends, August 10th, August 17th, in Annandale on Hudson, upstate, bringing it to New York in October. And we've been speaking with him, also with Norman LeBrecht. The Life and Death of Classical Music is Norman's latest book. And, gentlemen, I think we'll just have to leave it with, there's an anniversary. We'll see if it can change either of your points of view or the world's view of Elgar. And in the meantime, let me thank you both for being with us on Soundcheck today.
John, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
And coming up next, from England's national composer to multicultural New York, we'll get a report on Filipino rap in Queens. And then later, Nick Cave's new band, Grinderman, is getting lots of buzz after opening for the White Stripes earlier this week. We'll find out why when he joins us later. This is Soundcheck. In a moment, Australian rocker Nick Cave talks and sings about sex and the middle-aged man. But first, hip-hop is a worldwide cultural phenomenon. In New York, hip-hop is being shaped by recent immigrants who are embracing it as their own, and they're rapping in their native languages. But as these new groups gain popularity, they face a decision. Which language should they use in their music? It'll determine who listens. In Queens, Dorian Marina tells us about a group called NYFP.
In a crowded church gym in Elmhurst, Queens, teenagers leap from their seats and circle the hip-hop group NYFP, dancing and waving their hands in the air. Valerie Francisco, a Filipino rapper based in Brooklyn, was at the concert.
Someone is, rapping in my language. Word.
She says young people are connecting with NYFP's music, which is sung primarily in Tagalog, the national language of the Philippines.
They're speaking my language. I understand it in my own language. And, they look like me. That's dope. One, I can do it. Two, that means, that hip-hop isn't just, this thing that happens in the States with people on MTV with cars and girls. That hip-hop is this thing that can travel and people with other languages and other cultures can contribute to.
NYFP stands for New York's finest Pinoys. They're in their 20s now. All of them were born in the Philippines, and most immigrated to New York in their teens. And they're gaining a following among first and second generation Filipinos, or Phil-Ams. The recent show was in Queens, home to two-thirds of New York's 65,000 Filipinos. And over the last year, NYFP has brought their act across the city. 21-year-old M. the vocalist, the lead singer for NYFP, recites the chorus she sings in the song Mga Kababayan Ko, which means My Countrymen.
Mga kababayan ko, dapat lang malaman nyo, believe ako sa kulay ko, tayo ay Pilipino. I'm just saying that, don't be ashamed of who you are and what you're raising.
Be true.
Yeah, just be true to yourself.
You can feel the spirit of the song when you perform it, and especially in front of your countrymen, and your countrymen will just like stand there in awe. I'm proud of that, yeah.
The group's style is also distinctively Filipino. Rappers tell a story and use humor in verses and during performances. The flow of the lyrics is often slower and reminiscent of American hip-hop in the 1980s. Their audience is steadily growing, and they're planning a tour of the Philippines next year. But using Tagalog might also be a problem. Adora Penn is a promoter who arranged for NYFP to play a big show at the Knitting Factory last year. Penn says that the group must embrace English to break through to a wider audience.
You're here in America, generally who's going to understand you? And for everybody to understand, you have to speak the language.
Penn worked for Sony Music in the Philippines. She brought artists such as Celine Dion and Madonna to Filipino fans. Now, she's introducing Filipino performers to the American market. Penn points to the Grammy Award-winning group, the Black Eyed Peas, as a model for potential success. In 2005, the Black Eyed Peas released the song Bebo. Apple Diap, the group's Filipino-born member, wrote the lyrics. It recalls neighborhoods left behind in the Philippines and typical food like adobo. But the chorus, Bebo, which is slang in Tagalog for a girl, is mostly what the listener comes away with.
That album is a multi-platinum. It's around all over the world. Produce what America wants to hear from you, and then after that, you can uncheck who you are. You can make the people learn from who you are.
She's being extremely practical and smart about her business.
That's Marie Nieves Alba, another promoter who has worked with international hip-hop artists over the past decade. She disagrees with Penn.
What she's basically acknowledging is the fact that the marketplace is driven by American interests, right, and American culture.
But Alba says there's been a shift in American hip-hop fans. On a recent tour of hip-hop artists from Africa and Latin America, she says audiences would ask for translations and learn the lyrics, even if the choruses were in a different language.
I think the hip-hop community in general is definitely starting to demonstrate that it's interested in alternatives and it's interested in different voices.
Still, NYFP's newest song, Money, combines Tagalog verses with an English chorus.
We use English language because it sounds good and it's catchy.
For now, the questions of language and who will listen remain on the horizon. For WNYC, I'm Dorian Marina.
Coming up next, Nick Cave talks about music and aging and sex. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. 30 years into his career, the Australian songwriter Nick Cave refuses to go gracefully into musical middle age. His latest project is Grinder Man, a raw band within a band that marks a sharp departure from the albums he's recently made with his group The Bad Seeds. Grinderman's self-titled debut is filled with sexual frustration and macho swagger, inspired by some of Cave's American blues heroes. Nick Cave enlisted three of the bad seeds for the group, including drummer Jim Sklavounos. Nick and Jim both join us here in our studios. Guys, welcome to Soundcheck.
Howdy.
Hi.
Nick, you've often written in the past about, you know, about God and about death and love songs that are basically you and me against the world. Grinderman seems to be you in
just a... against the world.
Right.
Pressed it... up against the world.
I mean, it seems to be angry. I mean, there's feeling, you know, there's songs about impotence and lots of just unsavory stuff going on. Why this album now?
Impotence?
That's what it seems like. I mean, we're going to hear in a moment this song, guess, No Pussy Blues.
Okay, well, that's not someone who's impotent. That's someone who's just not getting any. it's not getting an opportunity to show his potence.
Yes, thank you.
But there is there's definitely a feeling of social impotence, I would say. Of being ineffectual. And, you know, and I think everyone feels like that.
Is this specifically a kind of musical take on Sex and the Middle-Aged Man?
That particular song?
Just...
the album in general?
Yeah, the album in general.
Yes.
Sorry to hear that. Since we mentioned this song, No Pussy Blues, tell us what's happening in this tune.
There's a story going on of a guy trying to pick up, you know, going through the trials of Hercules to pick up a particular woman and not being successful at his desired objective. But, you know, on a broader sense, it's about, I feel, when I'm singing it, I feel it's about all this stuff that's waved in front of our face that is supposed to make us happy but doesn't.
Now, let's hear a little bit from the self-titled debut album from the band Grinderman.
I saw a girl in the crowd. I ran over, I shouted out. I asked her if I could take her out, but she said that she didn't want to. I changed the sheets on my bed. I combed the hairs across my head. I sucked in my gut and still she said that she just didn't want to. Yeats. I tried best to stay up late. I fixed the hinges on her gate, but still she just never wanted to. I bought her a dozen snow white doves. I did her dishes in rubber gloves. I called her honeybee, I called her love, but she just still didn't want to. She just never wants to.
No Pussy Blues from the album Grinderman from the band Grinderman, featuring vocals and guitar from Nick Cave and drums played by Jim Sklavounos, both of whom are with us in our Soundcheck studio. Nick, over the years, I mean, you've done a lot of things that I can't use the word showcase because, in fact, you have to really look hard for it sometimes, but you have a very dark sense of humor. When you did the murder ballads, for example, you know, Staggerly and Pretty Polly and all these, you know, centuries-old songs, your versions were so over the top that people could easily be very distressed by them if they didn't get that kind of subversive, humorous streak.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of humor in what I do. I mean, I'm an Australian, and we have a particular sort of humor that's doesn't translate anywhere else but in Australia.
So and, how do you know when you've gone too far?
If I don't laugh.
I guess the answer is he doesn't.
That's a difficult question. For me, the Murder Ballads record was always a comic album. You know, I mean, there's obviously dark moments and all that sort of stuff, but for me, it was a comic. The fact that we were making an album called Murder Ballads to me was a comic concept. And to kind of so relentlessly across the record pursue this particular idea was funny.
Yes, it is I, Lottie, the curse of Millhaven. I've struck horror in the heart of this town. Like my
It's more like the other way around. I got a pretty little mouth underneath all the foam in the la 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 la. Sooner or later, we all gotta die.
What about on, you know, this album with Grinder Man? I mean, you've got, you know, the one song that mentions consensual rape as an idea, you know?
I guess that ain't that funny. But, you know, there's a, to that particular song, Go Tell the Women, it's a very ironic take on modern man, I suppose, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, I basically sit at a lot of the time in my office and write lyrics, and I'm on my own. And the only person I've got to entertain is myself, you know, that's mm-hmm. there. And a lot of a way I do that is write stuff that I think amuses me. And I guess the more I write, the more funnier stuff gets, and I guess angrier stuff gets.
But when we were making this record, you also had a chance to kind of entertain the band.
The troops.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I mean, you know.
It was very much something that was happening at the moment in the studio. You know, a lot of the songs, Nick had some of the lyrics written, but they were, everything was at best a sketch. Mm-hmm. So
were you guys
part of the process was him kind of revealing these words to us, and we'd get a good chuckle out of it, and you know, I think the humor in this one's a bit more accessible than a lot of the Bad Seeds ones, and I think Americans sometimes have a hard time seeing the humor in the some of the Bad Seeds lyrics.
The humor is often obscured by the kind of myth around, or whatever it is around me and the band, or the way people say it. Often the humor's obviously there, but it's not seen for what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a big mistake to think that Americans don't have a extremely keen sense of humor, actually, and a keen sense of irony. In England, it's often said that Americans have no sense of irony, which I find to be very, very untrue. And I think that in a way, if anyone can understand the humor in this, it's Americans. But it's often, like I said, it's often because the myth has become so kind of powerful to some people, people don't know whether I'm being funny or not, or whether I'm just, you know. Well, the Murder Ballads record's a perfect example. And, mm-hmm. and I'm here to say, hey, if it seems like it's funny, I'm probably trying to be funny.
We're speaking with Nick Cave and with Jim Sklavounos. Their new project is the band Grinder Man, which, I mean, to come back to the whole idea of what Americans do or do not get, this is a very American name to give to this band. It's from a John Lee Hooker song.
I took it from a John Lee Hooker song. John Lee Hooker took it from a Memphis Slim song. Memphis Slim probably stole it from someone else. But I don't know, you know. But it's John Lee Hooker has always, from pretty early on, informed a lot of what I've done. He's always, for some reason, I'm not really quite sure why, but he's someone I always seem to go back to, especially when I kind of run out of ideas. You know, I kind of put on John Lee Hooker, and there's something about. There's something very abstract about his songs and his the way he thinks and the way he improvises a lyric and where a lyric actually gets to. He starts off on one thing and it gets to somewhere else. And that's to me, that's hugely not only entertaining but inspiring. So credit where credit's due. I think there was an aspect that it's the right thing to do to call this band after a you know, John Lee Hooker song.
Let's actually hear a little bit of that John Lee Hooker song, which, as Nick Cave mentioned, he got from Memphis Slim, and who knows where it was before that.
You know they call me a grinder man. You know I can't be seen today. You know they call me a grinder man. I can't be seen in the day.
Friday late at night, babe. You know when everything is still. You tell all your friends. You have to see me late at night.
Great American bluesman John Lee Hooker and his song Grinder Man. Grinder Man is the name of the new band that Nick Cave and Jim Sklavounos have put together, along with bass player Martin Casey and Warren Ellis, who is best known as a violinist. But Nick, on your song Grinder Man, seems like Warren is doing everything but violin. First of all, tell us a little bit about, you know, what you've taken away from John Lee Hooker that we might hear echoes of in your song, Grinder Man.
Well, I think the title, you know. I think he may mention something like 7 days a week, or I'm open 7 days a week, or something like that. And that might even be from the Memphis Slim version. I can't remember. But it was just a wonderful title that sort of resonated all over the place. Now, I mean, John Lee Hooker's version's a bit more to the point, I would have to say.
And what is that point? What is he singing about?
I think he's singing about, you know, sexual competence.
Right. I'm a grinder man.
All night long and all that sort of stuff. Yeah. I operate in the night or whatever he's talking about. our version has a. There's a kind of haunting vulnerability behind the sort of bravado of the title, and it's something I think it's rather beautiful actually,
and it features some really interesting, very ambient sounding, some odd sounding loops that Warren has put down.
I think Warren approaches each project pretty much that he doesn't want to. Involve himself in this project in the same way as he involved himself in the project before. And I think with Grinder Man, it was get rid of the violin. You know, I'm not going to play. If Nick Cave's going to play guitar, I'm not going to play violin and do something else. And a lot of the songs are based around Warren's loops.
And this is one of them. This is the song Grinder Man from the band Grinder Man.
I'm the grinder man in the silver rain, in the pale moonlight. I am open lane. Yes, I'm the grinder man.
Song Grinder Man, featuring Nick Cave singing and playing guitar. Yes, that's right, guitar, not his usual piano. Jim Sklavounos is the drummer in the band Grinder Man. Martin Casey plays the bass. Warren Ellis playing loops and bouzoukis and mandolins and stuff. Nick Cave and Jim Sklavounos with us on Soundcheck today. Nick, this, you know, there are many surprises on this Grinder Man record, but for your longtime fans, probably none more than the sight of you or the sound of you, not at the piano, but in fact picking up the electric guitar. Why did that happen?
I was in New York, and Jim took me to a guitar shop, and I bought it.
But I think he suggested I buy a guitar. Is that right? I don't know. Something happened. I ended up in a shop in New York and walked out with this Fender Stratocaster. And I didn't know how to play guitar. And then we went a month later to record the record. And I guess in the back of my mind, I was thinking that we would get a guitarist to do the guitar, but I just sort of bash away at it in the meantime. But I think after it finished, everyone just felt really happy with the way the guitar was. I mean, I was.
Mm-hmm. So
you know, and I mean, Warren was adamant that if he said, I'm leaving the band if you don't play guitar, basically.
Well, you know, the guitar is a funny instrument because of the way it's tuned. Very often, it changes the way. A composer or a songwriter.
Totally.
So did that?
I mean,
happen?
Absolutely. The whole. I suddenly learned what rock and roll was about, for one thing. You know, I've been playing the piano, and you kind of try and work out songs that rock and roll songs that have been played. Velvet Underground, something like that, and it just doesn't work. And then you pick up the guitar, and immediately you can just play one song after another of theirs, and suddenly. I kind of had some understanding of that. It kind of sounds ridiculous because I've been in the game for like 30 years or something.
Yeah.
But some basic understanding of how, where rock and roll comes from in that way.
So let me ask you, Jim, is this really down to you that you dragged Nick into a guitar store and insisted he buy?
No, not at all. No, I think he was keen to give it a go, I just happened to know a good guitar shop in New York, and we went there again yesterday.
Uh-huh.
I bought another one.
You got another.
But so that means that you and Martin, the drummer and bass player in Grinder Man, you guys are the only ones who are actually playing the instruments you're known to play.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but now it's only a matter of time before Nick gets known as a guitar player, and I think everybody kind of has come to expect Warren to be a bit of a mad scientist. Mm-hmm. We never know what's going to come out of that room when he's got his pedals plugged in.
Jim Sclavounos and Nick Cave from the band Grinder Man are here. We keep calling it a band. It sounds like, though, that this was really not something that you intended to put together as a touring ensemble. I mean, you've been touring around with the White Stripes and stuff.
I have a solo thing that goes on. I haul out a piano and mm-hmm. play Bad Seed songs in a solo format. And I've had these three guys backing me for years as a kind of backing band. But they're not really a backing band, and they don't really, they're not comfortable being a backing band. And the music just sort of grew and grew and grew until it became virtually unrecognizable what I was doing on stage as Bad Seed songs. And we were just creating this kind of sound. And it was just very much a logical step to go into the studio and actually record some original songs.
So it just became a more collaborative experience.
Yeah.
Electric Alice, is that... Where did the idea that's somehow associated with Alice Coltrane come from?
Well, that kind of came out of a jam thing that we were doing, and the organ part in particular has a very kind of, it's not in her league, obviously, but there is a certain kind of Arabic jazz sort of influence going on through that, and to identify the piece, we used to call it Electric Alice, and I liked that name very much, and wrote the words around that name.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not a song about Alice Coltrane,
who passed away a few months ago. I guess probably by that point you had finished making the record.
I hope it wasn't her. I hope it wasn't the record that tipped her off the edge, because we're huge fans of her. we are huge fans of hers.
The song is called Electric Alice. Once again, we're speaking with singer and guitarist Nick Cave and drummer Jim Sclavounos.
Don't the stars look good tonight? Thought Electric Alice in the pale moonlight.
Don't the moon look big and bright? Saw electric alleys in the pale moonlight.
Electric Alice is a song from the band Grinderman, featuring my guests Nick Cave and Jim Sklavounos. Nick singing, Jim playing the drums, and Nick playing all this guitar after just 1 month with the instrument. That's a pretty impressive feat.
Look, actually, we have an extraordinary rhythm section. And if you have a rhythm section that's tight, and the guitar is an incredibly forgiving kind of instrument to play. I mean, you can bash out anything and it sounds good, I think. I can't play Stairway to Heaven, for example.
Jim laughs.
Not yet.
Nick, you mentioned before, you know, how the humor sort of went against the image people had of your music over the years. You were you had a key role to play in the Wim Wenders film, Wings of Desire, all those years ago. Much bigger role to play as the screenplay writer of the 2005 movie, The Proposition. Are you still doing film work now?
Yeah, I've written another screenplay for the same director, John Hillcoat. But The Proposition is done, which is basically a small, deliberately designed as a small English story. But in the meantime, people have seen The Proposition in Hollywood and love it, and he's been, you know, pulled in to do much bigger things. So we put that on hold till till Hollywood spits him out again. He can come back and do this.
What is it about film that keeps pulling you back?
Well, in regard to script writing, because it's easy. It's a really easy gig, and I can do it really quickly and efficiently. And for me, John Hillcoat comes to me and says, I want to, like with The Proposition, can you write a script that's an Australian Western? And it's just a matter of sitting down and writing that sort of stuff. You're given the theme. It's the idea or the theme that's the difficult thing. That's the difficult thing of songwriting for me, is sitting there and thinking, what am I going to actually write about?
Well, I've never heard anyone refer to screenplay writing as easy before.
It's a mug's game. All those script writers who sort of, with all their faux angst and all that sort of stuff. I mean, the only reason they say it's hard is because the longer it takes, the more money they get paid.
Uh-huh. All right, Nick, will there be a new Bad Seeds record, and will Grinderman somehow change?
Yeah, we finished a new Bad Seeds one, actually.
Mm-hmm. And did this experience of working with Grinderman somehow change the way?
Yeah, it did. It doesn't sound anything like a Grinderman record, but it's had a huge impact, I think.
It doesn't sound a lot like any previous Bad Seeds record either.
So what happens to Grinderman once the new Bad Seeds record?
Well, we're working on a new Grinderman one at the moment.
So you'll pursue both at the same time?
Yep.
Parallel lives.
Grinderman is the band, and the debut album, also simply called Grinderman. Nick Cave, the vocalist and guitarist, and Jim Sklavounos, the drummer, have been my guests here in the studio. Guys, thanks very much for being with us.
All right,
thank you so much.
This is Soundcheck.
I entered the room and the canned laughter. Ethel was angled across the dude's knee. And a bather, she just gave me a little exclusivity. In Death Charge of is something special. In Death Charge of is special to me.
All right, so we send you off into the weekend with more from Nick Cave and Grinderman. On Monday, a look back at some of the best live music made here in our soundcheck studio. We'll hear acoustic music from electronic music superstar Moby, world music hitmakers Kanono No. 1 from the Central African country of Congo, and Russian pianist Vladimir Feltzman. Soundcheck's technical director is Irene Trudell. The program is produced by Brian Wise and Joel Meyer with Allison Lichter. Our senior producer is Gisele Regatau, and our executive producer is Chris Bannon. We also had help today from Adriana Rodriguez. I'm John Schaefer. Have a great weekend, and be with us Monday at this time for the next Soundcheck.